Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga. Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works. Chapter 4, The Sacrifice, The Triune Path, and The Lord of the Sacrifice. Page 106. The law of sacrifice is the common divine action that was thrown out into the world in its beginning as a symbol of the solidarity of the universe. It is by the attraction of this law that a divinizing principle, a saving power, descends to limit and correct and gradually to eliminate the errors of an egoistic and self-divided creation. This descent, this sacrifice of the Purusha, the divine soul submitting itself to force and matter, so that it may inform and illuminate them, is the seed of redemption of this world of inconscience and ignorance. For with sacrifice as their companion, says the Gita, the All-Father created these peoples. The acceptance of the law of sacrifice is a practical recognition by the ego that it is neither alone in the world nor chief in the world. It is its admission that even in this much fragmented existence, there is beyond itself and behind that which is not its own egoistic person, something greater and completer, a diviner all which demands from it subordination and service. Indeed, sacrifice is imposed and, where need be, compelled by the universal world force. It takes it even from those who do not consciously recognize the law. Inevitably, because this is the intrinsic nature of things. Our ignorance, or our false egoistic view of life, can make no difference to this eternal bedrock truth of nature. For this is the truth in nature, that this ego, which thinks itself a separate, independent being, and claims to live for itself, is not and cannot be independent nor separate, nor can it live to itself even if it would, but rather all are linked together by a secret oneness. Each existence is continually giving out perforce from its stock. Out of its mental receipts from nature, or its vital and physical assets and acquisitions and belongings, a stream goes to all that is around it. And always again, it receives something from its environment gratis, or in return for its voluntary or involuntary tribute. For it is only by this giving and receiving that it can affect its own growth, while at the same time it helps the sum of things. At length, though at first slowly and partially, we learn to make the conscious sacrifice. Even in the end, we take joy to give ourselves and what we envisage as belonging to us in a spirit of love and devotion to that which appears for the moment other than ourselves and is certainly other than our limited personalities. The sacrifice and the divine return for our sacrifice then become a gladly accepted means towards our last perfection. For it is recognized now as the road to the fulfillment in us of the eternal purpose. But most often, the sacrifice is done unconsciously, egoistically, and without knowledge or acceptance of the true meaning of the great world rite. It is so that the vast majority of earth creatures do it. And when it is so done, the individual derives only a mechanical minimum of natural, inevitable profit, achieves by it only a slow, painful progress limited and tortured by the smallness and suffering of the ego. Only when the heart, the will, and the mind of knowledge associate themselves with the law and gladly follow it, can there come the deep joy and the happy fruitfulness of divine sacrifice. The mind's knowledge of the law and the heart's gladness in it culminate in the perception that it is to our own self and spirit, and the one self and spirit of all, that we give. And this is true even when our self-offering is still to our fellow creatures or to lesser powers and principles, and not yet to the Supreme. Not for the sake of the wife, says Yajna Valkya in the Upanishad, but for the sake of the self is the wife dear to us. This, in the lower sense of the individual self, is the hard fact behind the colored and passionate professions of egoistic love. But in a higher sense, it is the inner significance of that love too, which is not egoistic, but divine. All true love and all sacrifice are, in their essence, nature's contradiction of the primary egoism and its separative error. It is her attempt to turn from a necessary first fragmentation towards a recovered oneness. All unity between creatures is, in its essence, a self-finding, a fusion with that from which we have separated, a discovery of oneself in others. But it is only a divine love and unity that can possess in the light what the human forms of these things seek for in the darkness. For the true unity is not merely an association and agglomeration like that of physical cells joined by a life of common interest. It is not even an emotional understanding, sympathy, solidarity, or close drawing together. Only then are we really unified with those separated from us by the divisions of nature. When we annul the division and find ourselves in that which seemed to us not ourselves. Association is a vital and physical unity. Its sacrifice is that of mutual aid and concessions. Nearness, sympathy, solidarity create a mental, moral, and emotional unity. Theirs is a sacrifice of mutual support and mutual gratifications. But the true unity is spiritual. Its sacrifice is a mutual self-giving, an interfusion of our inner substance. The law of sacrifice travels in nature towards its culmination in this complete and unreserved self-giving. It awakens the consciousness of one common self in the giver and the object of the sacrifice. This culmination of sacrifice is the height, even of human love and devotion, when it tries to become divine. For there, too, the highest peak of love points into a heaven of complete mutual self-giving. Its summit is the rapturous fusing of two souls into one. This profounder idea of the worldwide law is at the heart of the teaching about works given in the Gita. a spiritual union with the highest by sacrifice. An unreserved self-giving to the eternal is the core of its doctrine. The vulgar conception of sacrifice is an act of painful self-immolation, austere self-mortification, difficult self-effacement. This kind of sacrifice may go even as far as self-mutilation and self-torture. These things may be temporarily necessary in man's hard endeavor to exceed his natural self. If the egoism in his nature is violent and obstinate, it has to be met sometimes by an answering strong internal repression and counterbalancing violence. But the Gita discourages any excess of violence done to oneself. For the self within is really the Godhead evolving. It is Krishna. It is the divine. It has not to be troubled and tortured as the titans of the world trouble and torture it, but to be increased, fostered, cherished, luminously opened to a divine light and strength and joy and wideness. It is not oneself, but the band of the spirit's inner enemies that we have to discourage, expel, slay upon the altar of the growth of the spirit. These can be ruthlessly excised, whose names are desire, wrath, inequality, greed, attachment to outward pleasures and pains, the cohort of usurping demons that are the cause of the soul's errors and sufferings. These should be regarded not as part of oneself, but as intruders and perverters of ourselves' real and diviner nature. These have to be sacrificed in the harsher sense of the word, whatever pain and going they may throw by reflection on the consciousness of the seeker. But the true essence of sacrifice is not self-immolation. It is self-giving. Its object not self-effacement, but self-fulfillment. Its method not self-mortification, but a greater life, not self-mutilation, but a transformation of our natural human parts into divine members. Not self-torture, but a passage from a lesser satisfaction to a greater ananda. There is only one thing painful in the beginning to a raw or turbid part of surface nature. It is the indispensable discipline demanded, the denial necessary for the merging of the incomplete ego. But for that, there can be a speedy and enormous compensation in the discovery of a real greater or ultimate completeness in others, in all things, in the cosmic oneness, in the freedom of the transcendent self and spirit, in the rapture of the touch of the divine. Our sacrifice is not a giving without any return or any fruitful acceptance from the other side. It is an interchange between the embodied soul and conscious nature in us and the eternal spirit. For even though no return is demanded, yet there is the knowledge deep within us that a marvelous return is inevitable. The soul knows that it does not give itself to God in vain. Claiming nothing, it yet receives the infinite riches of the divine power and presence. Last, there is to be considered the recipient of the sacrifice and the manner of the sacrifice. The sacrifice may be offered to others, or it may be offered to divine powers. It may be offered to the cosmic all, or it may be offered to the transcendent supreme. The worship given may take any shape, from the dedication of a leaf or flower, a cup of water, a handful of rice, a loaf of bread, to consecration of all that we possess and the submission of all that we are. Whoever the recipient, whatever the gift, it is the Supreme, the Eternal in things, who receives and accepts it, even if it be rejected or ignored by the immediate recipient. For the Supreme who transcends the universe is yet here too, however veiled, in us and in the world and in its happenings. He is there as the omniscient witness and receiver of all our works and their secret master, all our actions, all our efforts, even our sins and stumblings and sufferings and struggles are obscurely or consciously known to us and seen, or else unknown and in a disguise, governed in their last result by the One. All is turned towards Him in His numberless forms and offered through them to the single omnipresence. In whatever form and with whatever spirit we approach Him, in that form and with that spirit, He receives the sacrifice. And the fruit also of the sacrifice of works varies according to the work, according to the intention in the work, and according to the spirit that is behind the intention. But all other sacrifices are partial, egoistic, mixed, temporal, incomplete. Even those offered to the highest powers and principles keep this character. The result, too, is partial, limited, temporal, mixed in its reactions, effective only for a minor or intermediate purpose. The one entirely acceptable sacrifice is a last and highest and uttermost self-giving. It is that surrender made face to face with devotion and knowledge, freely and without any reserve to one who is at once our immanent self, the environing constituent all, the supreme reality beyond this or any manifestation, and secretly, all these together, concealed everywhere, the immanent transcendence. For to the soul that wholly gives itself to Him, God also gives Himself altogether. Only the one who offers his whole nature finds the self. Only the one who can give everything enjoys the divine all everywhere. Only a supreme self-abandonment attains to the supreme. Only the sublimation by sacrifice of all that we are can enable us to embody the highest and live here in the immanent consciousness of the transcendent spirit. This, in short, is the demand made on us, that we should turn our whole life into a conscious sacrifice. Every moment and every movement of our being is to be resolved into a continuous and a devoted self-giving to the Eternal. All our actions, not less the smallest and most ordinary and trifling than the greatest and most uncommon and noble, must be performed as consecrated acts. Our individualized nature must live in the single consciousness of an inner and outer movement dedicated to something that is beyond us and greater than our ego. No matter what the gift or to whom it is presented by us, there must be a consciousness in the act that we are presenting it to the one divine being in all beings. Our commonest or most grossly material actions must assume this sublimated character. When we eat, we should be conscious that we are giving our food to that presence in us. It must be a sacred offering in a temple, and the sense of a mere physical need or self-gratification must pass away from us. In any great labor, in any high discipline, in any difficult or noble enterprise, whether undertaken for ourselves, for others, or for the race, it will no longer be possible to stop short at the idea of the race, of ourselves, or of others. The thing we are doing must be consciously offered as a sacrifice of works, not to these, but either through them or directly to the one Godhead. The divine inhabitant who was hidden by these figures must be no longer hidden, but ever present to our soul, our mind, our sense. The workings and results of our acts must be put in the hands of that one, in the feeling that that presence is the infinite and most high, by whom alone our labor and our aspiration are possible. For in his being all takes place. For him, all labor and aspiration are taken from us by nature and offered on his altar. Even in those things in which nature is herself very plainly the worker, and we only the witnesses of her working, and its containers and supporters, there should be the same constant memory and insistent consciousness of a work and of its divine master. Our very inspiration and respiration, our very heartbeats, can and must be made conscious in us as the living rhythm of the universal sacrifice. It is clear that a conception of this kind and its effective practice must carry in them three results that are of a central importance for our spiritual ideal. It is evident, to begin with, that even if such a discipline is begun without devotion, it leads straight and inevitably towards the highest devotion possible. For it must deepen naturally into the completest adoration imaginable, the most profound God love. There is bound up with it a growing sense of the divine in all things, a deepening communion with the divine in all our thought, will, and action, and at every moment of our lives, a more and more moved consecration to the divine of the totality of our being. Now, these implications of the yoga of works are also of the very essence of an integral and absolute bhakti. The seeker, who puts them into living practice, makes in himself continually a constant, active, and effective representation of the very spirit of self-devotion. And it is inevitable that out of it there should emerge the most engrossing worship of the highest to whom is given this service, and absorbing love for the divine presence, to whom he feels an always more intimate closeness grows upon the consecrated worker. And with it is born, or in it is contained, a universal love, too, for all these beings, living forms and creatures that are habitations of the divine. Not the brief, restless, grasping emotions of division, but the settled, selfless love that is the deeper vibration of oneness. In all, the seeker begins to meet the one object of his adoration and service. The way of works turns by this road of sacrifice to meet the path of devotion. It can be itself a devotion as complete, as absorbing, as integral as any the desire of the heart can ask for, or the passion of the mind can imagine. To be continued.